Can you hear me, Matteo?
Yep. Hi, Tony.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm okay. I'm fine.
Hi, Marco.
Hey.
You know, Matteo, you have sent this link about 2 weeks ago to this YouTube page, this video page.
Oh, the three videos, evolution, fast forward.
Yes, that was very helpful. I viewed it a couple of times in that week, and that was quite good, quite helpful.
Good, good.
A lot of good information in that video.
Yeah, they're good meditation videos also. Have you seen them, Marco?
I don't think I have, no.
Yeah, they're done. You have to go.
I do. I just wanted to check in and make sure you guys are okay.
Yeah, it looks like everything's running.
Okay, I'm going to actually try to make you the host of the meeting.
Okay.
That way, if anything goes awry, you're able to take care of it.
Okay.
That.
Is it set so that anyone can come in at any time?
At this point, yes.
Okay, good. That's fine.
So it's good to see you. Good to see you, Tony. And I will be back next week at this time for the final chapter. God willing.
And you got my email that I can't meet the following week. Next week might be I won't be able to meet for a recap week.
Oh, okay. Well, I wasn't sure we would do it necessarily the next week. I thought maybe take a breath and find a time that really works for everybody. And
then I can.
Yeah, let's us maybe set, maybe, you know, have a moment to reflect now that we've gone on this journey. So whatever would be, whatever would serve that kind of dialogue, then you know, we could try to orient around that, I think. So.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good.
Awesome.
See you later.
Okay, ciao. What would you like to do, Tony? It looks like it's just you and I. I'm wondering if Marco Mossi, there's Marco Mossi. And I don't know if Flo will join.
Hello.
He might think that it's later. Hi, Marco.
Hi.
You know, we could shorten it up a little bit if you want. So let's see what comes out of it.
Yeah, let's see. I didn't really plan anything at all. So I'm open to whatever. How about you, Marco?
Yes.
Is there any approach that you would like to take for this meeting?
No, not in particular, but I thought that who Johnny hadn't he to do the summary, or there's no one in charge to make the summary?
No, I said that I would facilitate.
Yeah,
I said I would facilitate, but I wouldn't volunteer to make a summary of 47 paragraphs or 49 paragraphs. Yeah.
Yeah. But, no. I got confused because now we are the early session, and so I suppose Johnny is of course in the later. Session. Yeah.
That's
a good question. Yeah.
Something that we can think about is I wrote it down. I think you probably all see the patterning. The first seven paragraphs are somewhat of an introduction. We could kind of look at those together. Then paragraphs 8 through 27 is his abstract outlines for the mind of the Gnostic being. Mm-hmm. And after paragraph 27, paragraph 28, he transitions into the question of personality and impersonality, and then transitions that into questions of ethics and good and evil. And it actually culminates in the second or third to the last paragraph, raising the question of will evolution even be happening when this happens? And he poses the question and then answers that. So there's my 47 paragraph summary.
Thank you. Perfect. Yeah, but I understood it because I read it. But of course, if someone did not read it, but eventually, if you agree, I mean, did you, Tony, read it? Did we all read it? Or?
Well, I read the last chapter. I actually read the whole book, but I read it the last part, but I read it about a month ago or 2 months ago. And I read the last chapter of the Supermind. I read yesterday, and this chapter, half of it I read today. I somehow, to be honest, I didn't finish it, but I will be at the later session, and I have an hour or so, and you know, the last 20 pages I will read then. But in my version, there isn't that any paragraphs actually, so it's just page after page after page.
In German, there's no paragraphs?
There's no paragraphs. There's no...
Oh,
interesting.
I don't know. I mean, I have the older edition, I think.
But shouldn't also join also Florian?
He said that he would, but Florian isn't... space and time, he's operating on a different plane of space and time. I only thought 30 minutes before the meeting to remind him that the US turned an hour, has not moved time. And so maybe he'll show up at 6 o'clock your time. I don't know. He's very reliable when it comes to picking up at the airport. Oh, here we go. No, he just emailed. He said, unfortunately, I can't make it today. I missed that we have an appointment. So he just forgot about something on his calendar. And he said greetings to everyone.
Yeah. Oh, it's a pity because this is a session for Europeans, and then the Europeans are cannot join. But hopefully we will be more in the future. So
we only have one more session after this. My guess is that, and Flo hasn't been pacing with us this whole time.
Yeah.
Early on, when the sleep cycle didn't work for him, he fell off and started reading Sat Prem and the Mother, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah. He was once, I think there was at least.
He came when Debashish was on, and he came the first. He came to the first two or three meetings.
So, if you don't have a suggestion, may I then make a suggestion, which is the opposite, to be honest, of a summary. So I'm not. I will not take it. I will not be offended if you reject it, but I was thinking because my problem with these sessions, they are wonderful, but I have the impression we tend to defocus, we taking a whole chapter, then we tend to speak about everything and are not focused on the chapter and on what Sri Aurobindo said, and jump with our ideas here and there. Maybe we, instead of making it for the whole session, only just one experiment to one chapter, and then express our feelings and understanding or question or comments or whatever to that chapter.
You mean paragraph?
Paragraph. Sorry, to that paragraph. Instead of the whole chapter, maybe the beginning, the first paragraph, and then comment or open it to comments, question, or whatever.
Are you, nice. Do you,
yeah.
I feel great about that. Yeah, I would also recommend the 27th paragraph. It's the paragraph before the, and we'll help you out, Tony. Maybe we'll read it. But it's the paragraph before he makes the transition into ethics and personality. That paragraph, like, is an amazing summary. It's almost like a Upanishad.
Which book do you have? This edition?
Maybe. I don't know. I have this edition.
No, that's another.
Yeah, maybe we have different paginations. My paragraph 27 is on page 1026.
No.
Okay, how about, it's somewhere, 27 is almost in the middle of the chapter. So you could find it that way. And it begins, "It has been held."
It has been held. It is the incompleteness and aspiration. It has been held.
Ah,
good. The okay. Lower and transit pass. Okay. Oh, this is a long. This is a very long paragraph.
It's but they're all long. Most.
Ah, no, this is one page.
Most of these paragraphs are a page long.
Yeah. Okay.
So Tony doesn't have Life Divine in English. Maybe, Tony, you feel okay? I'd love if Marco read the paragraph and then maybe we can talk about it.
Okay.
Good. Marco, do you want to read it? I'm happy to read it also.
Yes, but since you are mother tongue English.
Oh, okay.
Because if I read it, it is a bit ridiculous sometimes because I don't know how to pronounce some words and so on. And okay, I can, if we continue, I can do the next paragraph.
But I'm happy to read.
Yeah.
Okay. Tony, do you have an online version? Do you have an English version?
Yes, I have a PDF version, but on my tablet, and just too complicated now to.
Okay.
And where are you calling from, Matthew?
I'm in Scotland.
Scotland, wow, cool.
Yeah.
So you're one hour back in time.
Yeah, it's four something. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe we should do just a 3-minute meditation or so.
Perfect, yeah.
I agree, yeah.
Today in Germany, there's Allerheiligen, right? Mm-hmm. It's Feiertag. It's free today in some states, and it's free in Bavaria. So in Nuremberg, I think you have free today, Marco.
Yes, yes. Heute ist Feiertag.
You know, it's this day. I don't know what it is in Scotland or in the United States, but we went to visit the grave of, you know, our, like,
In Mexico, it's called the Day of the Dead.
No,
yeah.
It's not a celebration. Just
right.
Just
All Saints Day.
Okay. And got that just, I think, 5 days ago, this contemplative teacher, Father Thomas Keating, died. And we could make those 3 minutes in remembrance and celebration of this great Christian contemplative thinker who was a great presence. He was a great man, definitely. You know him?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he died 5 days ago, I think.
I didn't know that. I don't have a meditation bell, but I can time it. And then after that, I'll just start reading. How's that sound?
It's okay.
Good. Thank you, Tony. the Gnostic being of the life divine. Paragraph 27. It has been held that ecstasy is a lower and transient passage. The peace of the supreme is the supreme realization, the consummate abiding experience. This may be true on the spiritual mind plane. There, the first ecstasy felt is indeed a spiritual rapture, but it can be and is very usually mingled with a supreme happiness of the vital parts taken up by the spirit. There is an exaltation, excitement, a highest intensity of the joy of the heart and the pure inner soul sensation that can be a splendid passage or an uplifting force, but is not the ultimate permanent foundation. But in the highest ascent of the spiritual bliss, there is not this vehement exaltation and excitement. There is instead an illimitable intensity of participation in an eternal ecstasy, which is founded on the eternal existence and therefore on a beatific tranquility of eternal peace. Peace and ecstasy cease to be different and become one. The supermind, reconciling and fusing all differences as well as all contradictions, brings out this unity. A wide calm and a deep delight of all existence are among its first steps of self-realization. But this calm and this delight rise together as one state into an increasing intensity and culminate in the eternal ecstasy, the bliss that is the infinite. In the Gnostic consciousness, at any stage, there would be always, in some degree, this fundamental and spiritual conscious delight of existence in the whole depth of the being, but also all the movements of nature would be pervaded by it, and all the actions and reactions of the life and the body. None could escape the law of the Ananda. Even before the Gnostic change, there can be a beginning of this fundamental ecstasy of being translated into a manifold beauty and delight. In the mind, it translates into a calm or intense delight of spiritual perception and vision and knowledge. In the heart, into a wide or deep or passionate delight of universal union and love and sympathy and the joy of beings and the joy of things. In the will and vital parts, it is felt as the energy of delight of a divine life power in action or a beatitude of the senses perceiving and meeting the One everywhere, perceiving as their normal aesthesis of things a universal beauty and a secret harmony of creation of which our mind can catch only imperfect glimpses or a rare supernormal sense. In the body, it reveals itself as an ecstasy pouring into it from the heights of the spirit and the peace and bliss of a pure and spiritualized physical existence. A universal beauty and glory of being begins to manifest. All objects reveal hidden lines, vibrations, powers, harmonic significances concealed from the normal mind and the physical sense. In the universal phenomenon, it is revealed. In the universal phenomenon is revealed the eternal Ananda.
Would you like, Matteo, to make a comment? Do you have an...
I wasn't thinking of anything, Marco.
Okay. Tony? You know? No, because I'm just asking because I don't want to rush in. Yeah, understand. Okay, then maybe I can. This is interestingly, because I underline everything that I find particularly interesting, and this is one paragraph there's where I underlined very few parts. So it's interesting, first of all, not how you pointed me out on something that I didn't see before. That's also very, very, very nice, because that shows how this can help us, we can help us, each others, to point out something that we have missed before. Because here, okay, he describes something that is already very, very a high realization. As I understand it, at least, he's not describing the normal moksha realization that a typical gnani yogi has, and sees everything as maya and is completely detached and lives also in a sort of bliss of the Brahman. But as I understand it, he's not speaking about that, or he's speaking about that, but not only that. He's speaking about an ananda that arises also due to the contact with the external world, where there is not only just the spiritual ananda in us, but that arises also due to the fact that we live in a material world. And in fact, he also speaks about the physical sense and physical vibration, a beauty and glory of being also in the on the physical level. And this is, I think, very characteristic of Sri Aurobindo, because implicitly, as I understand it at least, it hints at the fact that we have not to retire into some cosmic nirvana or in some cave on the Himalaya, but our ultimate aim, goal, is to reach this ananda also in the doing, in the, how does he say it, in the action, the action and in the works, which is extremely difficult, the most difficult thing, because when I, so, and I relate this now to my own experience, everyday experience, when I would like to make this active meditation, I'm continuously bombarded by thousands of things and I've completely forgot it. And this is absolutely far away from my possibility. In fact, he says here, there is an exultation, excitement, a highest intensity of the joy of the heart. And there is, but in the highest aspect of the spiritual bliss, there is not this vehement exultation and excitement. There is not. That I can relate very, very directly and good and directly to this experience, because sometimes one feels that some Shakti is acting. Sometimes someone feels that an experience is arising, and the vital and the ego maybe also become all excited and and something is happening and one is feels this joy, but just this excitement then impedes the experience to go beyond just this first excitement. This is at least my difficulty and experience with the energies that you feel working, and when you do meditation or whatever, sometimes they come also announced. And the most difficult thing is really to remain detached and also in front of something that is perceived as very exciting and positive. And he, in some sense, he is hinting at this. So I'm surprised to read this because I didn't see this, but he's actually describing, not of course what comes after, but this initial, what he says it is not. But this vehement exaltation, excitement, is an impediment sometimes in the realization. That's what I'm dealing with. Because then the ego comes up and says, oh, you are a big yogi, you're wonderful, great. And that's really a problem sometimes. But the good news is that he says, if at least correct me, it's my interpretation. As I understand it, he says, if you are able to go beyond that, then the experience can continue and go beyond this initial exaltation and excitement. And yes, this is a very powerful paragraph, I think, because in fact it summarizes the aim and the goal of the integral yoga. So these are my first impressions, a bit scattered and a bit disordered, but that's what I can say about it.
I think the reason that at this highest peak there's no excitement is that there's a great acceptance of everything that is, and that's already beyond excitement. So I understand this this scheme as, you know, being an illumination and then kind of having those subtle aspects of the totality of being coming up, then coming in the next level, the witness, which is the overmind, and the supermind, which is this total acceptance, but from a very different place and from this Gnostic light's perspective, which is a different type of mentality and a different type of being, and it's beyond mentality. So it's like a seeing and a constant understanding, and you understand the parts fitting together, like you're sitting somewhere, right? You have nature around you, you have those social structures, and there are a lot of parts that coming together. And with the eyes of the Gnostic man, the Gnostic woman, you see immediately how those are all fitting together in a very clear perception. And that's what I think that is, and the difference. He points out the different degradations of that, but I don't. So that's what I want to say. That's why I would say there's no excitement at the highest. So at the highest, you are then actually beyond that, and it's just an acceptance, but from a very different place, it seems to me. You know, for me, just, you know, reading this, I read the first, the chapter before, and now like the half, two-thirds of that chapter. And what comes up is I can kind of see, I can, you know, I can intuit what he points out, But as he said in the last chapter, you know, concerning the supermind, there are always like lower aspects that come up in the vital and physical, and those have their own, they have their own dynamic, they have their own will, and their own logic in a sense. And also, like I can see what he points out, but it's very painful actually to, I don't know, there's something about it that, you know, gets out a lot of shadow aspects, you know, a lot of you know, I don't know, fear and a lot of other stuff that come up for me that kind of make it difficult to live from that place. But you know, I have those glimpses where I can see this this coming together and this Gnostic perception, but it's obviously very difficult to do.
You mean, Tony, that fear come up? I'm not sure if I did understand this last part. In which occasions is it that you have this perception of fear?
It's not just fear, it's just all the lower physical, vital, mental stuff that hinders, you know, this clear perception.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's fear, it's all, a lot of stuff from different levels of, but just for me, from different levels of being. And he says, I think, even in this chapter, that you can go back and you can rework those aspects and you maybe, you know, maybe that's also just part of would be part of a yoga that would then go back and rework aspects of your being.
Yes, but does this lower vital and lower impulses, you mean they come up when you read these things or generally in our life, you mean, or what, in what sense?
No, there's a block. There's a, you know, between this.
Ah, yes.
This ultimate perspective, and where I am now, there's a lot of shadow.
Ah, okay. No. Sorry.
In order to lift from that place, I would have to, like, kind of clear that out somehow.
Yeah, I think. Most of us.
Yes.
Yes, but this is the sense of yoga, no? The lifting up of our lower vital, mental, physical, non-transforms aspects. No, I'm sorry, I just asked this because I thought that by reading Sri Aurobindo, if comes up fear, that would be something different. But if you mean generally, yes, that's a problem. Otherwise, we would have already realized all these things. And the problem with these things is that we are interpreting from our point of view something that can, in principle, cannot be I try only to relate it to some experiences instead of understanding it with a mind, with the logic. I try to relate it with some experiences at our stage, at my lower mind, lower vital stage, where I recognize something. But when he speaks, I don't think these things can be understood if not by a direct experience, but nevertheless, despite all our lower impulses, there is in us something, at least for me, that there's something that resonates. It says, yes, this is true. This is not just something vital, Because, you know, there are also other spiritual writings, other spiritual teachings, which maybe are not really spiritual. They are working with vital energies. But here, this is not just a vital energy. And that's why I like this part where he says it's not just excitement. So excitement is a word that we associate to the excitement of vital. No? This is much more than that. Or it's even not that at all. It is something that is, has much a higher quality. And in a certain sense, yes, I love this. But I love all this chapter on the Gnostic being because it is a description of the future of the human being. Well, no longer a human being. So.
Those four chapters, they are very, very good, very strong.
Which four chapters?
The last four chapters.
The last four. Yeah, these last six chapters of the book were all written in 1938, 1939, 1940. These weren't part of the original Arya. Funny, I appreciate you talking about fear in relation to this. I have it too. It's like the... This, for me, it's so wide, and where I am in that, there's the barriers to, I think the main barrier to achieving this yogically is fear. No matter what we call it, it's like the barriers to opening are fear. When there's a little opening that happens, it's like fear that closes it down. So as I'm reading this, I'm experiencing it also. And I can feel all those, at the best of times, I can feel those closures happening in me. It's like this wide, vast expansiveness followed by a closure. Maybe that closure is part of the integration process also. So it's like I don't try to push it away or anything. I think that it's just where we're at right now. Why I chose this paragraph is because oftentimes we're concentrated on consciousness, on chit shakti, and this paragraph highlights ananda, the bliss and delight. And there's so many. Sri Aurobindo wrote a Upanishad. I don't know if either of you have read it, Marco. It's this little tiny pamphlet that he wrote in Sanskrit, and then the archivist translated it into English, and it's called Sri Aurobindo Upanishad. And the last paragraph is kind of a chant, talking about like the whole path being a path of bliss and a path of delight. He's like chanting, O sons of bliss, O sons of bliss, S-O-N-S, sons of bliss, O sons of bliss. It's like the Satchit Ananda, and Ananda is the power that's like closest to supermind also, and kind of the entire reason for living. It's like when we as humanity, when we cycled through existentialism, and existentialism was the kind of a dominant paradigm on earth. It's like the classic thing of what is there to live for? Those classic questions that, what is it, Camus that asked and answered in the novel, The Stranger, those classic questions of existence. What is there to live for? And this path includes bliss. I haven't read it in a long time, but I remember that aspect of it. And so like this, it highlights Ananda and how Ananda can actually touch the different parts in our being. Toward the end, talking about in the mind, it translates into a calm or intense delight of spiritual perception and vision and knowledge. Then in the heart, into a wide or deep or passionate delight of universal union and love and sympathy and joy of beings and the joy of things. And then in the will, the vital parts felt as the energy of delight, of a divine life power in action, or a beatitude. This word beatitude, I like to include the definition because it's very simple and it gets lost in translation. The definition of beatitude is supreme blessedness, like the most highest blessing that can be received from something. This is beatitude. And so he says the delight of a divine life power in action, or a beatitude of the senses perceiving and meeting the one everywhere, perceiving as their normal aesthesis of things, a universal beauty and a secret harmony and creation of which our mind can catch only imperfect glimpses or a rare supranormal sense. And then in the body, this delight reveals itself as an ecstasy pouring into it from the heights of the spirit and the peace and bliss of a pure spiritualized physical existence. I feel fear when I read all of that stuff too, Tony, because I'm so far from it. And this whole chapter, actually, on Gnostic being, especially these last, this is paragraph 27, 1-7 is an introduction. Then he starts off on paragraph 8. He starts off at the end of paragraph 7 saying, that a more living picture of the Gnostic being supermind only could make. For the mind, abstract outlines of it alone are possible. So paragraphs 8-27 are only abstract outlines of what this could possibly be that he's doing to kind of satisfy our mental nature, which is actually the highest form that has evolved and mostly where most of our consciousness lies at our best is in the highest reaches of mind, which is so far below all of these broad strokes that he's painted that I can admit also there's fear in this expansion. There's fear in being. It scares me to touch it a little bit. I can feel a funny vibration of like inadequacy there's so much purification that needs to happen that the only thing to do is to surrender. And that helps the opening a little bit more. And then to use this mental formation as kind of a glimpse to guide me in what to reject also. The hostile forces, the fear itself, the despair, the disharmony, the egoic sense of separateness, all of that stuff. It's like fear and the egoic sense of separateness live together in these realms. So this thing, reading things like this, just having a mental painting, if you will, calling these paragraphs a painting, it like helps me and it's incredibly difficult. I had to read this chapter 3 times in order to even like my first pass through it this week, I couldn't connect with it. I was like so far from it that I couldn't even connect in with it. And then as I read it again, it went a little bit deeper. I feel like I need to actually probably read this chapter 30 or 40 times to really get a grasp of it. There's some absolute brilliance when he starts talking about impersonality and then talks about universal love and courage being impersonal states and how we connect in with these things personally. For me, these were brilliant examples of the play, the Leela between the infinite universal and the distillation of that infinite universal that our individual manifestation touches. It's like, wow, the beauty coming off of that paragraph is, I can't remember which paragraph it is. Anyway, I appreciate both of your sharings. I like a small group, and I like this paragraph approach also. If anyone has any suggestions to transition to something else, or if anyone has anything else to say, I'm happy to listen and be quiet for now.
Yes, there's a lot in it, right? In this chapter. I think that if something opens up, if some new aspects open up for you, there's always the fear of letting go of the old and also dying. You know, something in you has to die in order to step to the next level. And maybe you're afraid of letting go and letting a part of you die. I think it's a part of any transformation from, wherever you are to wherever you're going. So, Matteo, I would like to ask you, so it seems like this is, if I read it, it's always like it's a return to source, right? There's always something in this text that is like at this higher stage, it's a return to something. And the chapter is called the Gnostic Being. So there is this descent, and this descent is coming from the world. It's almost like the world is shining back at you, and it's also a return. So it's a return, and it's a it's as if, like, if you take this developmental view, like there's a greater, so Purusha, it gets greater, and there's a greater consciousness. Consciousness is expanding and rising and getting greater. It starts at one point, undifferentiated, and then evolves. And at first it's blurry, it's confused, and then at the higher stage, it's clear, it's very clear, but it's like, at the higher stage, it's like you're returning to where you was at the beginning, but with the absolute clarity. So you could say, like, I don't know, like what comes up for me in this is, I just think of metaphors, right? So there are certain ways of just thinking about, like if your perspective is extremely expanded, right? So like you have millions and billions of years, so time spans that like go way beyond your own lifetime. And like looking at things that have been there before you were born and probably will be there after you die. And, that's just, and those aspects, those things that, the world is just there. And it's kind of, this aspect of the world just being there, of the mountain just being there, it's always there. And, this existential aspect just shines through. And I think that people, let's say for whatever reason, they stumble upon, they walk along the Grand Canyon or something like this, like in America, right? So those people, they have just a national history of 200 years. And then you stumble upon this natural phenomenon that's like a million years old, and just let you think, oh God, those rocks, they are here like millions of years. And this gets you into a kind of a different type of perception, and this type of perception of just this existential nature of the world and its existence, that's what shines, that's what comes through, I think, that's the illumination, that's part of the illumination of the world just shining at you back. And you can see kind of this timeless aspect of the beauty of nature, for example, in the Grand Canyon or something like this, or in nature in this mountain or something like this. And that's I think what can happen if you plug in into those higher realms. that's just what comes up for me. I don't know. My
question. Tony, you're microphone.
Is it like a return to source? Is that what he gets to?
Super simple reflection on that question. It's not an answer to that question. Sri Aurobindo said, and I don't know what chapter, but we have passed through it. He talked about if return to source were the sole meaning, then like what's the use of the lila? It's actually to unveil and to collaborate. Humans are the first beings that have come with the ability to collaborate in the evolution of human consciousness, aiding and speeding it up. Is that return to source? I think it's more of an unveiling and having the true being emerge. I think that it's more like the lila and delight of that play, that game, or that act. Yeah, I don't know if that's a helpful.
Yes, that's helpful, because I mean, if you engage in anything like yoga, it's always, you always think of a progression. I want to get something. I want to progress in my yogic practice, and you seek for some goal. And is the goal just the next step, or is it maybe, just a circle? It is a return to source. So.
Oh, you muted right at the end there.
That's what I get from you.
It's like the dance between the finite and the infinite. In the finite world, every height contains a larger height. Every depth contains a deeper depth. And the point of existence is to realize our immanent divinity that is infinite, that is God. And the human, what differentiates humans from animals is, on a really basic level, is aspiration, is discontent, is a movement toward something that we are not currently, an understanding that we're in transition and that there will be something that we are evolving into, whether we can conceptualize of it mentally or not is one thing. But then on that level, then everything becomes a tool to aid in that process. Pain, suffering, any sort of discomfort becomes a tool to aid in that process. I
think it's more, rather than a return to source, I would say a revealing that we are the source.
So maybe that's a semantic thing. I wouldn't want to, but I feel those the textures is, I feel those textures differently. The words return to source and the words kind of a revealing and an unveiling of what we, of what our true person is, and having that true person actually come through, because all evolution that's happened up until now has been at the rate and pace of Prakriti, of nature, the mediatrix. And it's like the transition that we're going through right now is a transition into consciousness, and consciousness being the executor rather than just traveling along inside of these bodies.
May I connect to what Tony said previously with just this little anecdote where you said that you look at the Grand Canyon, for example? This is something I was thinking about, not Grand Canyon, but at looking at nature, at phenomenon of nature in general. That's what my experience when I see a phenomenon of nature, or I look at the Milky Way in the sky, or big forests, or just also animals, or in general, I have this experience, well, experience is maybe a bit too big word, but this inner feeling of the manifestation of source, of as a source of something that maybe I'm not seeing it as it is, because only at the supramental level you have this knowledge by identity with things, but nevertheless also at our mental level, maybe it's higher mind level, you can perceive this. It manifests as an of, I don't know, in English you say of, A-W-E.
Awe.
It's manifests like an awe in me. Or at least, I think you can see this also in the description of the astronauts that look down to the Earth. That many of them describe something like that, where they have also this feeling of union. They don't see the Earth as made of many nations and separate by each other. They see only one living being, and where on this living being live humans as one humanity. They don't see this as divided countries that eventually make war against each other. And there is this inner perception of oneness, or inner perception of a force that manifests, that however, if you look at only at the purely material mental level, you see only as science does, only particles and chemistry and not much more. I think this is also something that in this same paragraph Sri Aurobindo is hinting at, the universal beauty and a secret harmony of creation. This universal beauty that you can see in looking at the creation, where you perceive somehow a hidden secret harmony of which, and he says this here also, of which our mind can catch only an imperfect glimpse or a rare supernormal sense. But he says our mind can catch something of this. So in a certain sense, yes, it's true that he is writing these things at an abstract level. And of course, The Life Divine is an intellectual work. It is philosophical work. It appeals to the mind, without doubt, this is, of course. But I can somehow relate also to something that goes beyond, little beyond mind here. There is this inner feeling, this inner perception of force, of a harmony, of the source, of also of this Ananda, which of course we can glimpse only a little bit. But it is not true that we cannot relate at all to these things. I think there is something. Sri Aurobindo himself said that they once I think this was with the Synthesis of Yoga, not Life Divine, but somewhere they asked him why he does not revise. It was, I think this was the last years of the 1950s, why he does not revise his writing and so, and about the Synthesis of Yoga. And, so, and he once said, I don't want to lower myself again to that level of consciousness. Yeah. So, but he in some sense confirms, yes, I'm writing here at an intellectual level, but this is not something intellectual. You cannot grasp this with the mind. Yeah. Even though there is this, you can catch a glimpse of it. Yeah. And so I don't consider Sri Aurobindo a philosopher, also not an intellectual. He uses the intellect to communicate with the intellectual beings. But, and in fact, it's not a coincidence that he wrote then Savitri, which is goes beyond. It is, he called it overmind poetry, no? Yeah. But here, this sentence, I think, makes a connection between our perceptions at the human, normal human level, and what he's writing in this paragraph.
You know, Marco, there's a documentary by Peter Russell called Global Brain. It's in German. Also, you can Google it. It's very interesting. So he put this Gaia metaphor into use, and he thinks of the whole Earth as a global brain. You can watch it on YouTube. I saw it like 10 years ago. And
yeah, I saw it also many years ago. I know. I don't remember the details. Yes, it's very nice. Yes, yes. Yeah. But it relates on this Gaia theory practically, mm-hmm. You know?
It doesn't hold up fully, but it's very interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yes. I think humanity is going now towards this higher mind state, not supramental state, but higher mind state there, that we perceive that we are becoming one in the diversity, as Sri Aurobindo used to say. Yes, I think this. May we read another paragraph, if you like, or maybe I can try.
I like, yeah, please. Which paragraph do you, Tony?
Yeah, suggest you, Tony, because I like them all.
And I'm happy to suggest another also.
I don't have paragraphs.
Oh, right. This paragraph where he talks about universal love and courage, and would you be interested in having to read through that?
Yes.
Two paragraphs later, paragraph 29. So we read paragraph 27, and then 28, he introduces the question of personality and impersonality, and then he's leading to the question of ethics. What role would ethics have to play in the advent of the Gnostic being?
Yes, may I make also another little suggestion that you can reject, of course, but we already tried in the last time, we tried to make the circling. You remember?
Yeah, Tony wasn't here. I don't know if you watched the video at all, Tony.
I watched the one where you were there with Matteo and Marco. I watched that one, but I didn't watch it fully.
Okay, we started off, a friend of mine does work, sacred circle work, and there's a few pointers that she gets at that can help deepen, and that's going in a going in and sharing in a geographic circle and having signaling with Zoom that mute, when you're on mute, you're done talking, and then having a pause between sharing so that there's less crosstalk going on and less response, but more of like a deeper concentration going on. It's the sacred circle idea is ancient, and is the, in Native Americans it's like talking stick, but this is like the Zoom version of that. And she even sets a deeper aspiration to try to have doing the five breaths in between sharing to allow the mind and vital to settle and aspire to connect in with the soul and connect in with the group soul that's present and the geographic distances between us. I can probably say a lot more, but that's a basic introduction. Did you want to try that again, Marco?
Yes, I suggest to try it because I think it's better that, okay, not necessarily in geographical sequence, oh yes, of course, also, but that first one, then the other, then the third, and then again back, because, you know, it's also a character matter. There are people who are very extrovert and they speak and speak, those a little like more introvert, they wait until, and so it's better to distribute when one has finished. So for example, now you are in Scotland, okay, then do you go from the north to the south or from the south to the north? But well, from the north, okay, you read and then you make a comment, then I'm in the northern Bavaria, then it's my turn, and then Tony is southern Bavaria. So Matteo, Marco, Tony, and then again, Matteo, Marco, Tony, Matteo, Marco, Tony.
So. I'll pass though. If you want me to read, I'll hold a comment.
So, okay, I can read. I can read, yes.
Oh, you want to read? So yeah. Then go Marco, and then you can comment or not. Marco, Tony, and then me? Yeah.
No, I didn't understand the question. Sorry. What
do you mean? So you're going to read. You can comment or not, and then Tony, and then me. But let's pause after you're done reading, or after you're done reading and then commenting, have like a four breath pause, and then Tony shares, and then a four breath pause, and then I could even pass also. In sacred circle work, it can come to me. I could take five breaths and say I have nothing to add and pass to whoever. Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to do it.
This is what I wanted also to say. It should also not be forced, the saying. So if someone just wants to listen, passes. That's not a problem. But that we can distribute equally a bit the time and the opportunity to speak, I would say. No? Mm-hmm. Okay, I can read if you... I'm not very good in reading, but it's especially in English.
If you would like me to, I'm happy to read, Marco.
Okay, if it's not too much a burden for you...
I love to read.
And it's your
mother. I'm not going to comment, so I'll read and then pass to you. So after I'm done reading, let's have a little meditation.
Okay, and who begins then? Tony, do you begin? Tony, Marco, Matteo.
Good.
Okay.
Good, Tony. Good. Yeah. So this is paragraph 29. Impersonality is in its source something fundamental and universal. It is an existence, a force, a consciousness that takes on various shapes of its being and energy. Each such shape of energy, quality, power, or force, though still in itself general, impersonal, and universal, is taken by the individual being as material for the building of his personality. Thus, impersonality is in the original undifferentiated truth of things, the pure substance of nature of the being, the person. In the dynamic truth of things, it differentiates its power and lends them to constitute by their variations the manifestation of personality. Love is the nature of the lover. Courage, the nature of the warrior. Love and courage are impersonal and universal forces or formulations of the cosmic force. They are the spirit's powers of its universal being and nature. The person is the being supporting what is thus impersonal, holding it in himself as his nature of self. He is that which is the lover and warrior. What we call personality of the person is his expression in nature status and nature action. He himself being in his self-existence originally and ultimately much more than that. It is the form of himself that he puts forth as his manifested, already developed natural being or self in nature. In the formed, limited individual, it is his personal expression of what is impersonal, his personal appropriation of it, we may say, or as to have a material with which he can build a significant figure of himself in manifestation. In his formless, unlimited self, his real being, the true person or Purusha, he is not that, but contains in himself boundless and universal possibilities. But he gives to them, as the divine individual, his own turn in the manifestation so that each among the many is a unique self of the one divine. The divine, the eternal, expresses himself as existence, consciousness, bliss, wisdom, love, wisdom, knowledge, love, beauty. We can think of him as these impersonal and universal powers of himself, regard them as the nature of the divine and eternal. We can say that God is love, God is wisdom, God is truth or righteousness, but he is not himself an impersonal state or abstract of states or qualities. He is the being, at once absolute, universal, and individual. If we look at it from this basis, there is very clearly no opposition, no incompatibility, no impossibility of a coexistence or one existence of the impersonal and the person. They are each other, live in one another, melt into each other, and yet in a way can appear as if different ends, sides, obverse and reverse of the same reality. The Gnostic being is of the nature of the divine and therefore repeats in himself this natural mystery of existence.
I have to say something, right?
You don't have to say anything.
Okay.
No, if you want to pass, you can pass, of course. But
so what comes up for me is this idea of the one, going from the one to the many, this expression from the one to the many, and a development in form back to the one. So from the one to the many to the one, and this individualization process that is part of an interaction with the Purusha or the individual self and the world, and those very different types of individual factors that influence a person and leads to very different personalities, and often with he talks about in this segment of a unique self, often with very unique parameters. So it's just a very unique, always a very unique combination, but this unique combination gets back into a oneness, into this Gnostic being. And from the many to the one, and from the one to the many, that's what comes up for me in this segment.
Yes, the one thing I like very much of this paragraph is that, again, as I used to say, I try always to relate it to something that I can understand or that I have lived. And it reminds me of how I came to yoga. I came to yoga not through Sri Aurobindo. I first discovered, so to speak, the Vedanta non-dual teachings of Shankaracharya and non-dual teachings. And I studied by myself a bit the yoga philosophy, very in general, without going into interior yoga and Sri Aurobindo. And there was the first revelation for me that there was someone telling me there is only one without the second. So this Brahman, who is one, and that's the impersonal part. And this was for me a discovery. Something that I felt very, very true in myself. And for a long time, I saw this as the absolute truth and ultimate reality. However, there was always the question, okay, but why do I perceive the world as divided, separated beings? And if everything is one, why is and the Vedanta tells you that it is Maya and so on. Here instead, then there came the second phase, so to speak, when I read Sri Aurobindo, where he describes this aspect, not only here, but also in other parts, about that the fact that impersonality, this Brahman and personality of eventually you can imagine a God which is separate from the existence. This is something I never liked. But on the other side, Sri Aurobindo is not saying that this is not true either. That's also part of the truth. If we rise at higher levels of consciousness, we see that impersonality and personality are the two aspects of the same being. We can be impersonal and personal at the same time. We can be one and the many at the same time. Of course, if we try to understand this with mind, it's no sense. It's just a wordplay. But I feel, if I look in myself and I feel this very strong to be true, and I like also very much how he relates this not just to cosmic forces, or to the universe, or to a cosmic mind or something like that, but he speaks also of love, courage, and he said these are love and courage are impersonal and universal forces or formulations of the cosmic force. Love and courage, something that we relate to a very personal aspect of very individualized beings. Whereas he says, no, it's not only that. It's love and courage are impersonal and universal forces or formulations of the cosmic force. When I read this for the first time, I was a bit confused because I tend to relate this to persons. I love a person. A person loves me. But this as a universal force or formulation of a cosmic force. But once I read these things, I don't know, but how others, how for you it was, but so many things became clear and almost self-evident and obvious in some sense. Because a lot of philosophy, also philosophical, very down-to-earth mental questions can be answered if you accept this aspect. Otherwise, what is love? Well, a biologist would say, well, okay, it's something that nature has invented for the procreation of the species, and there's then something like love, but it's just only a neurobiological chemical reaction in your brain so that you mate and have children. But here Sri Aurobindo says, no, it's a universal force, a cosmic force. And this makes much more sense for me than this purely materialistic explanations, which leave a lot of questions open. Whereas if I look at from this point of view, a lot of things become clear. At least for me, that's my reaction, as many others.
This paragraph to me stood out as another one of those Upanishadic paragraphs. And for me, it really exemplifies why the path of integral yoga many moons ago was termed integral non-dualism, purna, Advaita, right? Purna being complete or integral, Advaita being non-dualism. It's like love is universal, and then it in the individual, it's also susceptible to the distortion of the admixture of all the parts of our being. It's susceptible to the distortion of our separativity of consciousness, susceptible to the distortion of our ego. Same with courage, same with all of the universal qualities, aspiration, receptivity, goodness, equality, progress, courage. It's all those as universal forces are divine and very pure. And then as they come into our being, the distortion takes over, the admixture takes over. But in Synthesis of Yoga, he makes a lot of supported statements that yoga union actually isn't taking place unless there's alignment of the individual with the cosmic, with the universal, and with the transcendent. And why I said that this paragraph is such a great example of integral non-dualism is because the individual is a subset of the cosmic. There's no individual operating outside of the cosmos, except that it is operating outside of the cosmos, and the mind can't hold that, right? It's like the Upanishad kind of help, the Isha Upanishad helps quiet the mind with all these koan statements. One unmoving that is swifter than mind, that the gods reach not, for it progresses ever in front. That standing passes beyond others as they run. In that, the master of life establishes the waters. And in the Upanishad, that is the absolute. It is the Brahman that is the cosmic and the individual, and also, not to the exclusion of, and also that which is outside of the cosmic and the individual. And the next verse in the Upanishad is that moves, that being the absolute, and this being the infinite, being the cosmic, that moves and that moves not. That is far and the same is near. That is within all this, and that is also outside all of this. And this paragraph distills that. It shows all the qualities of the absolute. Love, God. God is wisdom. God is truth or righteousness. And then kind of toggles back and distills them, shows what they can be in the individual consciousness that has advanced past our separativity of consciousness. And it's like all these triads. At one point in this chapter, he places before us, I can't remember where, but he's like, all of the triads have to be known, and personality and impersonality, and that which is neither personality nor impersonality. These are the triads. And knowing that, and as well as Sat, Chit, Ananda, mind, life, body, these are all triads, but also that and this, and that which is neither that or this. Marco, you said that to the mind, this sounds like a wordplay, but the mind, I've had this conversation with people that they're like, oh, this is mental masturbation or something like that. It's waxing philosophical, but it's actually not that. To me, it's mantric. It's like the thing that can quiet the mind so that the realization can come. Sri Aurobindo in the Kena Upanishad defines the word Upanishad as inner knowledge, or that which enters into the final truth and settles in it. And that kind of leads me back to the definition of the triple status of supermind, another triad, the thing that founds the unity and then modifies the unity in terms of the many and the one, and the toggle back and forth between the many and the one. And then the third status of supermind is supports the many within the one. So to me, it's not just going back to source. It's living in the manifestation as the many and the one, and neither of those two and both of those two. And this is like the mind just can't ever understand this. And in the same Upanishad, there's Agni. This is the Kena Upanishad. There's Agni, there's Vayu, and there's Indra. There's mind, life, there's matter, and it's a koan, yeah. There's matter, and there's life, and there's mind. And it's so interesting because the Upanishad, I think it's the third part of the Kena Upanishad, the folly of the gods is the eternal conquered for the gods, right? The absolute conquered for the manifestation. But in the victory of the gods, like the gods came into being because of this manifestation, and the gods looked around, or the human ego looks around and says, ours the victory, ours the greatness. And when Agni is presented, when matter is presented with that, matter has no idea what this mighty greatness is. It has no idea what's been placed before it. Vayu, in turn, gets challenged by the eternal. Vayu says, I can expand into everything. The eternal places before Vayu a blade of grass, and he can't expand into it, and he has no idea what it is. And Indra, who represents higher mind in the scheme of the Vedas, Indra only could come closest to the touch of the absolute. And Indra was transported into a whole different dimension and told by the goddess Uma, the daughter of the snowy summits, that it was the eternal, because Indra, higher mind, was puzzled also. And then she says something so beautiful. It is in the victory of the eternal in which you shall grow to greatness. Sorry to like wax a long, do a long talk on the Kena Upanishad, but it's like distilled in this paragraph. And I just find it so beautiful. Anyway, I've probably said enough. Thanks for listening.
Can I ask you a question, Matteo? And that is, what exactly is, in my personal experience, what is knowledge by identity? So I read half this chapter. Knowledge by identity, I can accept everything that comes my way, you know. Is that knowledge by identity? I'm always confused. Is it, knowledge by identity? I can identify with mental concepts. I can identify with things in the social world. So this knowledge by identity, could you maybe, not explain it, but differentiate maybe what is it and what is it not?
a hard question, Tony. What is it? It's not mental consciousness. It's from the realm of the supermind, and is first detected in a different consciousness than we're operating in. So it's very hard to explain to the mind what it would mean to perceive the past, present, and future of this ceramic vessel that's in my hand, the different parts of earth that it came from, the different hands that have touched it, perhaps pain and suffering that the animals that we're eating are coming through, the whole consciousness of the earth. There's intimations of this in intuitive mind, but it's only flashes, and it's limited.
So
it's a different consciousness.
If I walk down the street and I see, let's say, just as an example, I see a homeless person, and I identify with this guy or with this woman, whatever, and it's acknowledged by identity.
No, that sounds a whole lot more like vital empathy than knowledge by identity.
Yes. Yeah. Because I had
which is beautiful. Like, yeah, like I don't.
Well, I think not necessarily with the homeless person, but just of things that I see and then kind of identify with, but it's also very painful. But that's probably not what Aurobindo would mean by knowledge by identity. I think it's probably very.
I think this would be maybe two, one part. You can also, I think, identify with the pain of someone else, but most probably, yes, it's probably would be more a vital identification. But how I understand Sri Aurobindo in when he speaks about the knowledge by identity is the knowledge of the essence of things, also persons, of the forces, of everything with which we get in contact to in one way or another. The essence, you take an object, yes. After all, well, we could also try to maybe clarify what it is not, with the hope that something remains intuitively of what it is. For example, if you see an object here, I have a calculator here, I see an object, yeah. But how does this contact of my consciousness with this object come into being? There is a light ray, it is reflected on this object, it goes to my eyes, who, by the way, as you can see, are not very good. And this light goes to the retina. The retina transforms it in biochemical information. The brain elaborates this information. And then suddenly you perceive something, and then there is a meaning. You have the perception of the thing. But this is by far not a knowledge by identity, because it is a very, very indirect contact. It is mediated by other forces outside, and you, your mind, your brain, and all your being, physical being, also distorts this, it filters this, and reshuffles these informations and presents it to your consciousness in a way that has probably nothing to do with the object itself. Because the essence of the object is probably something very far away from what our senses present to us. Sri Aurobindo uses the word sense mind. We are the mental, the intellectual being, the scientists especially, use a sense mind. They restructure the world by the senses. Whereas as I understand it, on the supramental level, there is a direct contact of the essence of the thing with the thing itself, without mediation of the... There should have been another where also, when they were presented the photographs of the disciples, okay, I don't know if they can could tell you about their story, but they said, this man is so-and-so, this woman is so-and-so, this is such a type of being, this is another type of being. And on the base of this, they made also a little selection of the who was allowed to come into the ashram and not. Most of the time they accepted it, especially those who were more difficult, not the big yogis, quite the contrary. But they saw, evidently in the photograph, something of the essence of this being, which your normal senses, your sense mind, cannot see or cannot see so directly. Because after all, if you like an analogy, we are living in a sort of, like in the film Matrix, we are living in a sort of virtual reality. We get all these informations and our brain elaborates this information and presents these informations as the brain has elaborated it to our consciousness, which is not our brain, which is something else, but that's how it arrives. And we are living in a certain sense in a virtual reality. The Gnostic being is the being that knows things and also beings, persons, in its essence and their essence as they are really at all levels. So that's a very brief summary of how I understand it.
You know, I see it a little bit different. I think that this, you know, Gnostic knowledge by identity, this doesn't carry with it the knowledge, the scientific knowledge that you get if you, for example, make some experiment and then you see, for example, that there are sound waves that you you can't actually measure certain things through this knowledge by identity because you need some device, okay? You have a certain ray of light waves and sound waves. A dog, for example, hears different a different spectrum of sounds, and there are other, like your smartphone gets some signal that you can't detect with your own, physical, mental apparatus. You don't see everything that's going on. I think there's a limit of this knowledge by identity. So you can't know radio waves by knowledge by identity, for example. So it is a past, present, and future, and it's not identifying with things as you see them at the moment, I think. And it's not necessarily identifying things, I don't know, like in the vital realm or in the personal realm. I think it would take this and then put it in this in a larger frame, and the type of seeing would be one where you see those parts kind of coming together in a higher identity. So if that makes sense.
Yes, then there is, you're right, there is also the temporal aspect, yes. It's not a knowledge by identity at the moment. That's maybe not the case. I'm also stumbling a bit and trying to find out words how I intuitively understand the things. But what comes to my mind is, for example, the mantra. You say sounds. Yeah? The mantra is a sort of an embodiment of the consciousness that the mantra is supposed to convey. Somewhere I don't remember where Sri Aurobindo, this was perhaps in the some chapters ago where I don't remember his words, but he says this, where a mantra is, if you look at it from the superficial mental point of view, so from the sense mind, it's just sound. But if you hear it, not look, hear it, also with your physical ears, with a higher consciousness, you get something from this vibration, which is just a physical sound vibration, that is contained in this vibration, that your normal ears and your normal brain filters out and does not realize anymore. Whereas the supramental being, he hears also what we hear, but hears in the vibration, in the sound vibration, much more than what we hear, because it does not filter out the essence and the consciousness that is contained into the voice of someone, for example. There are passages in the agenda or the mother's agenda where mother said that there was a moment where she had problem with deafness. She was deaf or almost deaf. She had great problems to hear physically with her ears, the people talking. But there are passages where she said, when someone spoke from a higher level of consciousness, not from the ordinary, then suddenly she could hear perfectly everything. So this means that in the physical vibration of sound, there is more than just a vibration of molecules. And the gnostic being seems to be able to catch this something that we don't catch. But okay, this may be a very long discussion. When I will become supramental, I will tell you more details.
It's very hard to define these things. We don't have the language. But I would say to answer Tony, it is all of those things that you said that it's not. It actually includes all of that and a consciousness that we can't perceive by mind. It includes all the finite knowledge to know about, that we can know about anything. It includes the mind of the scientist. It includes the mind of the sense mind. It includes all the vital levels. It includes all of these things, all of these levels of consciousness. It's just from a consciousness that I cannot report on. We don't have the language for the bringing mantra into it is great. I found the footnote that you're talking about. It's in my book, it's in the chapter Ascent Towards Supermind. And he says the word expressing the idea has the same power if it's surcharged with the spiritual force. That's the rationale of the Indian use of the mantra. The footnote on, I don't know if you have paragraphs, but it's the Ascent Towards Supermind. And also in Sanskrit, the word shabda, it means word, but it also, it contains, it's another one of these triple aspects. It's the sound of the word, it's the meaning of the word, and it's the spirit of the word. And that could be the same in English. It depends on the level of consciousness that the word is from which the word is being delivered. That's I can relate with on a very base level. I can relate, Marco, with what you just shared about the mother. Sometimes I have a hard time hearing nonsense, and it's like there's a part of my reality that has that where it's just like not around me anymore. It's like I don't even know what to say. It's an interesting unfolding that I can say. I think this channel that we're using right now is going to be used by another group in 6 minutes. I'm pretty sure that was the limit of the meeting. Marco Morelli said that he could join for 90 minutes because he had another group meeting on this channel in 6 minutes. So I'm fine finishing with a meditation, but I also don't need to get the last words in. If anyone wants to say anything, I'm happy to stay on for a few more minutes.
Yes, it's an honor to have you here, Matteo. Will you join us next week?
And Flo has to join us next week because I'm going to be at his house in Berlin.
Yeah, next week.
Great. Yeah, I'll be here next week. For the last chapter. Yeah, for the last chapter.
Great. So you have been in Bavaria, right?
Yeah, I was in for 3 weeks. I did a circle from Munich to Neuschwanstein to all the way to Prague and then back to Nuremberg.
We come around. We could play a little bit, or we could have played a little bit of pool. I could bring a friend, and then I could ask you some questions that I have.
I love billiards. I haven't played in years, but I think I spent more time in college playing billiards than studying. Where do you live, Tony? I've forgotten.
It's near a town called Rosenheim. Rosenheim, and it's south of Munich, between under this in a very provincial village under the Wendelstein, between Germany and Austria, between those.
We may have gone through there. How close are you to Neuschwanstein Castle?
Neuschwanstein.
No, sorry, pardon my pronunciation. Neuschwanstein.
it could mean something.
Oh, am I saying it in a way that could mean something completely different?
It's about 150 kilometers or so. So it's not
okay. Okay.
But it's good. It's good. You are there next week. Great.
Yeah, I'll be in Berlin from Flo's house. So I'll see you all. I'll see you all next week.
And I will be. I will be here for the next call at 1 o'clock on Friday.
Mm-hmm. 1 a.m. The call in a couple of hours, yeah.
Oh, no, I think I will be in another world, yeah. Another plane and part of my being.
Sushupti.
Yeah, Sushupti.
Yeah, Swapna. Jagrat. Lovely. Thank you, friends. It's an honor to be with you. I love discussing this text and everything that comes up. It's not an easy thing to get at.
The next week we have again at Thursday at 5 or 6?
Next week the United States will change their time. So next week for you, for all of us, it will be at 6 o'clock.
Six o'clock. Okay. Okay.
Good.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And bye-bye. Next week.
Yep. Okay. Cheers.
Ciao.